Good afternoon, you're tuned to Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, the 1st of April, the year 2015. Jeff Brown with you here on the Juno Afternoon. Today we'll get a promo of this month's Wildlife Wednesday presentation by Riley Woodford, Small Mammals in Southeast Alaska. We'll get an update on activities at the Zach Gordon Youth Center with Donnie Burris. We'll also talk with the world's only stand-up economist, Yoram Bauman, here to speak before the Juno World Affairs Council on comedy, economics, and carbon tax. We'll also get a preview of Ryan Peterson's new film, Stories and Science of Our Transboundary Rivers. Then in April, first Friday artist Mitch Watley will be here to discuss his work. Then writer Zomanak Bruno at Music More today on a Juno Afternoon.
For National Native News, I'm Tristan Otto, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A landmark decision has been handed down in a two-year-old federal lawsuit that alleges violations of the Indian Child Welfare Act in Pennington County, South Dakota. Yesterday, a federal judge ruled that the Seventh Circuit Court, the Pennington County State's Attorney, and the Department of Social Services routinely violate federal law when temporarily removing Native children from their homes. The suit was filed by Native parents and the Oglala and Rosebud Sioux tribes. Victoria Wicks has more.
The lawsuit involves only officials operating within Pennington County, but it sets a precedent for the entire state and an example for the nation. Federal Judge Jeffrey Viken found that parents are not given a chance at emergency hearings to get a court-appointed attorney before the state decides to move the children into foster care or other out-of-home placements. At these hearings, parents aren't allowed to view petitions or affidavits, present testimony, or cross-examine the state's witnesses. Judge Viken wrote that children have been removed from their homes without evidence presented to support the removal, and that written findings after hearings, quote, bore no resemblance to the facts presented at the hearing. Rapid City Attorney Dana Hanna, along with the ACLU, represents the plaintiffs. He says his clients aren't seeking monetary damages, but only changes in practices.
Our lawsuit does not seek to remedy past violations. What it seeks is to prevent future violations.
Hanna says about 60% of children who are the subject of these hearings are Native, but he says the opinion has broader implications.
Non-Indians, white people, black people, Hispanic people, whatever, also have been denied the basic due process requirements that the court addresses in these hearings. So what the Indian tribes here and the Indian plaintiffs have done is not just get a landmark legal victory for their people, but really for all families in South Dakota.
Judge Viken did not rule on an allegation that the Department of Social Services fails to train its social workers to follow the law. That issue might be settled when parties submit their suggestions for guidelines on how to proceed on these cases in the future. Deadline for those proposals is May 1st. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Wildfires burned more than 200,000 acres in Northern California's Klamath National Forest last summer. Now the Forest Service proposes a restoration plan the Karuk tribe says will exacerbate fire hazards in the future. The tribe proposes a plan based on Tech tribal ecological knowledge instead. Christina Onnested reports.
The Forest Service plans to salvage log more than 11,000 acres in the Klamath National Forest and then plant nearly 5,000 acres of tree farms for future logging. But Craig Tucker, the natural resources policy advocate for the Karuk tribe, says the plan encourages future catastrophic forest fires.
When we go in and heavily log an area and then replant Doug firs, you get a stand of trees that are all the same age. You get a stand of trees that's very dense. And these things can go like a tinderbox in the event of a wildfire. You know, a healthy forest has mixed-age trees, mixed species.
The Karuk tribe is proposing an alternative based on tribal ecological knowledge, which eliminates tree plantations, scales back the logging to about 3,000 acres, and leaves most of the burned forest to recover, which Tucker says encourages biodiversity and fire resiliency. The public has until April 13th to comment on the Forest Service's plans. Christina Onnested, National Native News, California.
The Pamunkey tribe of Virginia will have to wait 4 more months to find out whether or not they will become the first federally recognized tribe in Virginia. The Department of Interior was supposed to make a ruling by the end of March, but notified the tribe that their decision was on hold till the end of July due to strong opposition and fears of a new casino. The Pamunkey have held a reservation in Virginia since 1789, claimed Pocahontas as a tribal member, and applied for federal recognition in 2009. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Support by NativeGiving.org, empowering Native children and families through community giving.
All the donations made on NativeGiving.org go toward the organization you choose.
Information on successful innovations at NativeGiving.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau and Carinan FM in Juneau. First guests are Patricia Weary and Riley Woodford here to talk about tonight's Wildlife Wednesday presentation, Small Mammals in Southeast Alaska. What's here, why, and why not? Riley and Patricia, thank you for coming down to the station
today.
Thank
you.
So before we get too much further, you want to talk about the Wildlife Wednesday presentation
as a
whole?
Yes. On behalf of Alaska Wildlife Alliance, the Southeast Chapter, I want to thank this radio station for the opportunity to advertise our Wildlife Wednesdays for an entire season and in many years past. And we are very grateful for that opportunity.
Well, it works both ways. We're grateful for you to come down to the station. So, Riley, small mammals. What kind of mammals are we talking about?
So it's arbitrary. Draw the line. What's small? What's big? So I drew the line at porcupines. Porcupines are small. Wolverines and coyotes are big. So anything smaller than a porcupine, I'm covering. So there's 29. We just discovered a new one. So there'll be 29 animals. I'll give an overview and talk about them.
Did you take into account the cuteness factor?
I did. I tried to put in pictures of cute baby animals. And so, most small mammals are cute. They are cute. I'm surprised that some people don't think mice are cute. Some people they don't like mice, but mice are pretty cool.
What's so cool about them?
Well, they're the base of the food chain.
Caught you on that one, Mr.
They're the
biologist.
Base of the food chain. They're cute.
Before or after the fur?
Yeah, I don't know. I like mice. I like mice. Voles. Voles are not mice. Voles are very closely related to mice. So they're little rodents. So you hear people talk about mice and voles, but they're not moles. Moles are more like shrews.
So what makes small mammals notable other than just they're small and cute?
Well, in Southeast Alaska, they're really interesting because of where they are and where they're not. So we have we live in a place that was, almost completely covered by glaciers just a few thousand years ago. Obviously, it was not very good habitat for small mammals. So the ice melted and animals came in largely from the north and the south, and they came down the river corridors like the Stikine or the Yunik or the Chilkat, and they got in through this barrier of mountains and ice fields. They got into Southeast Alaska and certainly colonized the mainland, and some have gotten out to islands. And there's also an interesting thing that there were little pockets of habitat that were never glaciated that were refuges for animals. And so animals not only came out of those pockets of habitat, refugia, they were isolated for 50,000, 60,000 years, maybe longer. So in some cases, they evolved into different species. And we have small mammals here that are found virtually nowhere else in the world.
What makes a mammal a mammal? Is it just that they suckle their young?
That, and they have fur, and they are born, they're born in basically, they're live born placentas. They're in placentas and have hair. Yeah, basically those are the qualifications for mammals, warm-blooded.
What eats them, and what do they eat?
Well, it depends on the animal. Mice and voles, things like that, they eat a lot of seeds. They eat little vegetable stuff they find. They're eaten by basically everything bigger than them. Marten, which are kind of cat-like weasels, eat a lot of mice and voles. Owls and raptors eat them. Basically anything bigger than anything smaller will eat it. And then some animals like squirrels, which, we've got thousands of red squirrels around here, will eat birds and bird eggs. in the springtime. So they're almost exclusively vegetarians most of the year, eating seeds and nuts and things like that. But when baby birds are around, they'll become voracious nest predators and eat birds.
Of the small mammals we're talking about, what's the most common small mammal in southeast Alaska?
Well, it's probably either the deer mouse or the redback vole. So those are both little tiny rodents. And deer mice are very common. They're very classic-looking mice. They're dark on top and really light-colored underneath. So if you ever see one, you can kind of take a look at them, and they're pretty easy to identify. And then redback voles are a little bit bigger than deer mice, and they actually do have a very reddish-colored fur along their back. So if you're somebody whose cat occasionally brings in things that it kills, typically it's going to be three things. It's going to be a shrew, which has a long pointed nose, a redback vole, or a deer mouse. And once in a while, they'll bring in invasive mice, house mice. But we don't really have too much of a mouse problem here as far as mice and rats go, especially compared to a lot of places. And that's because we're actually pretty good with garbage. I mean, this is a pretty clean city relative to a lot of cities, so we don't have invasive rodent problems like that.
Is the same hold true of most of the other parts of Alaska?
It depends. Yeah, I was talking to the Sitka area biologist, and he said that they're getting more of a rat problem in Sitka because of chickens. It's become so popular to have chickens now that people have lots of chickens and lots of chicken food and all that. And so that's a pretty good draw for rats.
Are they killing the chickens, or are they going after the feed?
The feed. They're mostly going after the feed. I mean, no, rats will eat eggs and things too, but rats will eat anything they can get. But they're probably not going to take on a chicken. But they'll certainly eat chicken food. Mm. So I've only seen a rat once in Juneau on Gaston Avenue. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, it's a gross rat in the sewer or in the gutter. And
what do you think it said when it saw you?
It's like, oh, no. It was like, well, it jumped in the sewer and ran down the drain. So, he probably wasn't too happy to see me.
What in the animal world is the equivalent of a four-letter word?
Eek. With three E's.
So your talk is tonight at 7 o'clock? I'm sure you want to give us the details about the talk.
Right. So 7 to 8 o'clock. And we are at the Thunder Mountain High School. It's on the second floor in the library. You can use the elevator, or there's stairs up there. And then we reward you for that terrible, difficult stair climb with cookies and other yummies and hot drinks. And there's a lot of opportunity before and after to visit with the speaker and just to talk amongst themselves to the audience. And I really like that we stay long enough for that to happen.
And you've got a special deal going on tonight. If you can identify the mammal shown in the poster, you get in free.
It's always that case. Everybody wins because it is free to everybody, open to everybody and free.
Well, then what's the name of the animal that's on the poster?
You mean the weasel?
That one. Yeah. Yep. It's a little weasel, the ermine.
Is it a weasel or an ermine?
It's both. It's an ermine. Some people call them ermines. Some people call them weasels. I like to call them ermines because there's a few kinds of weasel.
If you're going to be going and looking for some of these small mammals, where's the best place and what's the best way to approach the mammal?
Well, I think that probably the most watchable small mammal is porcupines. You know, they're pretty easy to find and they're pretty docile. If you see one, you can get kind of close to it and watch it and watch what it does. Red squirrels are really easy to watch. They're really common. If you want to find mice and voles, you can flip stuff over. Go look underneath things. That's where they often live. I've gone out in the winter and followed where cats go, like at night when they're hunting, and you can see they go into wood piles and they look underneath things and then brush piles and stuff like that, find their tracks and see where they're going.
All right, Riley Woodford and Patricia Wary, thank you very much for coming by. Patricia, do you want to go over the details again when the talk is
7 to 8 o'clock, Thunder Mountain High School.
Thanks, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. This time of year, high above the clouds caressing the upper reaches of the Sierras, soars the most majestic bird you are never likely to see or hear, the semi-fixed-wing silver delirium. This enormous creature, with a wingspan of some 4 yards, a sleek metallic silver body almost as long as its wingspan, and huge winged feet, visits our region once a year during its annual migration from its home in Tierra del Loco, a remote island promontory rising out of the southern Pacific. Until recent years, the Delirian was known only to the natives, a scant 73 in number, of its home base. Then, in 1989, a Russian spy satellite detected its presence along the northern California coast. It being that brief period known as Perestroika, the Soviet authorities, mistaking the Delirian for a missile, alerted the U.S. Air Force. Jets were scrambled, and not until they had attained a height of 40,000 feet did Americans catch their first glimpse of this all but mythical creature. Why the name? Tierra del Loco is the one and only protectorate of the ancient Micronesian Principality of Deliria. I'm Michael Stein for BirdNote, and we're urging you to keep watching the skies.
It's 16 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon here on April Fool's Day, a national holiday for me. In the studio with me now is Donnie Burris. Donnie, you're going to tell us about things happening at the Zetco News Center.
Yes, today I want to talk about the upcoming Easter egg hunt, as well as a sneak peek into our summer camps that we're going to offer this summer.
I'm assuming the Easter egg hunt is not happening at the Zetco News Center.
It is not. For one, we can't possibly hide our 7,000 eggs over there. It's not big enough. And then our kitchen is getting underway. Finally, we're so excited. So we are under construction, finally, for our brand new renovated kitchen. Our Easter egg hunt is going to be at Thunder Mountain High School. We figured we could probably hide 7,000 eggs there. And it is our 31st annual Easter egg hunt. And it is this Saturday, April the 4th at 10 a.m. So I wanted to come and let everyone know that that Easter egg hunt pre-registration has been going on for a while now, and it's open until this Friday at 7. So they can come down to Zach Gordon Youth Center, or they can go to the Parks and Recreation main office down at City Hall to register for kids for the Easter egg hunt. It is $5. And that includes a little goodie bag that each child receives when they check in on the day of the hunt, as well as a chance for them to find their share of 7,000 Easter eggs.
Are these plastic eggs or hard-boiled eggs?
They are plastic eggs.
I asked
filled with candy.
I ask because there's a story of 1 year. They use real eggs.
Yes, I remember that story. So I've been at Zach Gordon almost 9 years, and I can't remember the year they did, but they used to do real eggs out at Floyd Dryden, and Crandall Mark told me a story about them putting the eggs out and then the ravens coming and, like, attacking the eggs. So they decided that it might be wise to go over to switch to plastic eggs for the sake of not having the ravens destroy the Easter egg hunt for the kids. It is a nice concept, though. You'd have to be fast. And so the Easter egg hunt is for ages 0 to 10. Yes, I said 0. So they can have babies. You know, everyone isn't a 1 yet. Sometimes there's 6-month-olds that come with their moms. And we'll divide the kids into 3 age groups. So 0 to 4 will be on the football field. 5 to 7 will be in the front of the school in the Boulder area. And then 8 to 10-year-olds will be out in the wooded area behind the school. So we're encouraging all parents and kids to get to Thunder Mountain High School on Saturday by 9:30 and to check in the commons area. There they'll get their goodie bag, and then there'll be smiling faces telling them where to set up for the hunt. Although it's 7,000 eggs, I can't stress enough how important it is to be on time. The hunt starts at 10 sharply. And those kids will find 7,000 eggs in literally 3 minutes. So if you show up at 10:05, then your child might be kind of sad that there are no eggs left. So it's very important that parents get there at 9:30 to check in and get there and prep themselves for the race to find 7,000 eggs. It's definitely a great day. And again, that's this Saturday at Thunder Mountain at 10 o'clock. But of course, get there at 9:30. You can pre-register at Zach Gordon Youth Center up until Friday at 7 p.m. And we're open from 11 to 7. And all those who pre-register will get their name put in a drawing to win a grand prize, which I know what it is, but I won't say. It's a surprise. But it is a grand prize. It's a really nice prize. So all those who pre-register can do it at Zach Gordon or Parks and Rec, the main office down at City Hall. Zach Gordon's open from 11 to 7, and they can pre-register until Friday. And if they don't get a chance to pre-register, they can still come and register the day of. We ask that they be there at 9 o'clock. So from 9 to 9:30 is registration on that day. Also, I wanted to talk about the summer camps, and it's just a sneak peek. I won't go into all the details, but we are releasing our summer camp classes and descriptions later on today on our web, and I wanted to give those parents who are early planners like myself time to look at our camps and start planning summer because it is coming fast.
And well, we didn't have a winter.
I missed the winter. I must have blanked. And so we'll be offering 10 camps, which are 10 weeks of camps. They're a week long from the week after school lets out until the week right before school. And we will have camps. The first camp is going to be called Summer Fun. And that camp is going to be about beach exploring, fishing, and swimming. We'll also have Climb Juno, where our climbing guru, Jesse Palomino, will be taking kids to climb around Juno. We'll have a spectacular sandcastles camp, and we'll spend a lot of time at Sandy Beach making sandcastles. We'll do an H2 Awesome camp, which is kayaking, and that's actually a great camp full of water adventures, which is very fun. We're going to have an art camp this year. We're going to have a Summer Olympics, which is wacky sports, so balancing water balloons on your head while being dizzy running from one end to another at Cope Park. Very wacky themed Summer Olympics, which is great. There's going to be some hiking classes, also some picture-taking classes where we give the kids cameras and they get to explore Juno and they get to take pictures that are meaningful to them. They print them out and then make a book at the end of the camp. Each of our camps are very reasonable at $80 a week, and they are from ages 8 to 13. And all of our camps are from 1 to 4:30 p.m., and for specific dates, Juno can go to our website by the end of business day today to look at those and get good details. I really am excited this year about our camps. We have two wonderful JVs with us this year, Jesuit volunteers who are very full of life and adventure, and we really have a great staff who's ready to go out this summer and have a good time with the kids.
Donna, you're full of enthusiasm. It's hard to imagine those camps not being a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. It's been great over at the Youth Center. Even with our construction, the kids are still coming in every day and playing basketball. The lounge area is kind of off limits because that's where they're working, but our basketball court is still open. The weight room is still available. The outdoor court is still getting good use. We've been borrowing space out of the Young Parents Center, using their space to kind of set up our snacks and stuff for the kids. So it's been really nice. I'm excited about this year and the things that are going to happen in 2015.
Donnie Burris, thank you so much for coming by the station. Is there anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No. Thank you so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 1st of April, 2015. April Fool's Day, a day for pranks and hoaxes. Joseph Boskin, a professor of history at Boston University, said the practice dated back to the reign of Emperor Constantine, who was challenged by his court jesters that a fool could run the empire as well as he did. So he appointed a jester king for the day, and one of the jester's acts was to decree an annual day of merriment. The story ran in the Associated Press and a couple of weeks later discovered that Professor Boskin had made the whole thing up. It was a hoax. And many people suspected a hoax when, on April the 1st, 2004, Google announced its new Gmail service. But indeed, it was for real. It was on this day in 1826 that Samuel Maury received a patent for his gas or vapor engine. It was the first internal combustion engine. He'd been interested in flammable vapors since the early 1800s. He discovered that turpentine, when mixed with air, was explosive, and he designed an engine to make use of it. It had a carburetor, two cylinders, valves, and cams. And Mr. Maury wrote, "Is there not some reason to expect that the discovery of the internal combustion engine will greatly change the commercial and personal intercourse of the country?" He had no idea. It's the birthday of Anne McCaffrey, born Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1926, best known for her Dragon Riders of Pern science fiction fantasy series about Earth colonists on the planet of Pern living in a medievalish society with genetically engineered dragons. And it's the birthday of the author Milan Kundera, born in Brno, Czechoslovakia, in 1929, best known for his novels The Unbearable Lightness of Being, The Book of Laughter and Forgetting, and The Joke. He was expelled from the Communist Party for anti-party activities in the early 50s. Though he was pro-Marxist, he was active in the Prague Spring of 1968. His books banned by the Soviets after their invasion later that year. 1970, he left Prague for France, was stripped of his Czechoslovak citizenship. Immortality, which he published in 1990, was his last novel written in Czech. Now he writes in French. Here's a poem for today by John Keats, some familiar lines from Book One of Endymion. "A thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its loveliness increases, it will never pass into nothingness, but still will keep a bower quiet for us, and a sleep full of sweet dreams, and health, and quiet breathing. Therefore, on every morrow, are we wreathing a flowery band to bind us to the earth, spite of despondence, of the inhuman dearth of noble natures, of the gloomy days, of all the unhealthy and o'er-darkened ways made of our searching. Yes, in spite of all, some shape of beauty moves away the pall from our dark spirits." A Thing of Beauty, lines from Endymion by John Keats. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. Throughout the month of April, their favorite poem project, Florida, invites Floridians to submit their favorite poem. Florida-based listeners can submit their nominations at poetryfoundation.org/favoritepoemflorida. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Engineered by Noah Smith and produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
During the month of April, close to 20 local photographers will be sharing their work in the Alaska Photographic Arts Association's annual spring show. Get glimpses of the art that goes beyond the viewfinder. Landscapes, nature, portraits, and more. You'll be startled and amused. That's the Alaska Photographic Arts Association Spring Show during the month of April. There will be an opening reception on Friday, April 3rd in the KTOO building. Join us.
It's about 30 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon here on the 1st of April, the year 2015. In the studio with me now is Carl Brodersen and tonight's speaker for the Chino World Affairs Council, Yoram Bauman. Thank you very much for coming down to the station tonight.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So, Yoram, you are a stand-up economist. What is a stand-up economist?
Well, I have a PhD in economics, but I make a living doing stand-up comedy. So I tell jokes about politics and economics.
I saw a little bit of your performance at a comedy club online, and it was great. You had the crowd going in stitches. Do you find it difficult to – do people come there to listen to talk about economics?
Occasionally. Like, I run the humor session every year at the annual meeting of the American Economic Association. Otherwise, there are a lot of events that I do where people actually don't know that I do stand-up comedy about economics. They expect, you know, a boring lunch speaker or who knows. And it turns out that they get a stand-up economist.
How did you discover you were a stand-up economist?
I was in graduate school. I wrote a parody of an economics textbook just to blow off steam because that's what you do when you're in graduate school. And then one thing led to another. And I performed it live once and got into stand-up comedy as a hobby. And now, 10 years later, it's my career.
You're also a teacher.
I have done some teaching. I'm on semi-permanent comedy hiatus from academia. But yes, I have been a teacher, and most of what I do now in the educational realm is I work on cartoon books. So I have a couple of cartoon economics books and a cartoon introduction to climate change that are terrific books.
What do people laugh at mostly when you're doing a comedy routine about economics?
I think what makes it work is that people have stereotypes about economists. So anytime you have stereotypes, you can do comedy. So, you know, the stereotypes about economists are that we're kind of money-grubbing and hyper-rational. And so I have jokes about how, you know, you might be an economist if you adamantly refuse to sell your children because you think they'll be worth more later. or you might be an economist if you don't read human interest stories because they don't interest you. People like those sorts of, making fun of economics and also hopefully providing a little bit of insight into the way that economists think about the world at the same time.
Who do you consider your audience to be?
I do talks for economics audiences, but then I also do a lot of talks for just the general public. I think especially folks who are interested in economics but have always been a little maybe afraid to get into it, or many people have had a bad experience in economics class, and I'd like them to give it another try.
Do you hear from people who had a bad time in economics class and went to your performance and it changed their life?
I don't know if I'd say it changed their life, but they no longer have to go to therapy.
What's wrong with economics education?
I think there's part of it where it's sort of inevitable that you have to have some graphs and you have to do some math, but I feel like a lot of the most interesting stuff in economics has been kind of buried. We still teach economics today more or less the same way that Paul Samuelson taught it in 1950, and there's a bunch of new stuff that's come out since then, especially game theory and strategic interactions, that's really interesting and fun, and for some reason you have to take three classes before you can ever study any of that stuff. So we have a chapter in the cartoon introduction to economics about auction theory and some things about game theory and cake cutting games. And those things are really fun, and you can understand a great deal about economics from looking at those small person strategic interactions instead of just always focusing on supply and demand and market mechanisms.
You need to define game theory a little bit more.
Sure. So game theory is the study of strategic interactions between individuals. So if you've seen the movie A Beautiful Mind, which I highly recommend for everybody, if for no other reason than because it is the last time that an economist will be played by anybody as attractive as Russell Crowe. it's the study of things like the prisoner's dilemma, or you can study poker. Or auctions. And so it's the use of math and analysis to study strategic interactions. So I'll give you an example. There's a famous game that goes all the way back to the Bible that involves cake cutting. So you say, all right, if you have a divorce settlement or you're trying to split a piece of cake between two kids, then how do you create a mechanism that allows them to fairly divide that? And, you know, there's a classic I cut, you choose algorithm where one person cuts, the other person chooses. You can ask questions like, well, is it better to be the cutter or the chooser? And it actually depends on how much information you know about the other person and how much you think they know about you. And so you can very quickly go from a game like that that's seemingly very simple to something that really has depth and interesting content in it.
What do you do when you're a stand-up economist and you deal with hecklers?
I encourage them to come to my economics lectures the next morning.
How's your act changed over the years?
I have a little more material now, and I have a little bit more comfort level, I think, in my own abilities as a comedian, and so I have a little more patience. So we were just listening to Garrison Keillor, actually, and Garrison Keillor speaks very slowly. And as a, I think when I first started doing comedy, I always wanted to go fast to kind of get to the next punchline as quickly as possible. And now that I have a little more faith in my material, a little more confidence, I can tolerate those pregnant pauses a little bit better.
You're talking tonight at 5 o'clock in front of the Juno World Affairs Council. What are you going to be discussing?
I'll be doing some jokes about politics and economics, and then also talking about climate change and carbon taxes and environmental tax reform, which is what I work on when I'm a serious economist. So basically the idea that we can use the tools of economics and the power of capitalism to protect the environment, especially by changing our tax system. So the idea that I work on is that we should have higher taxes on bad things like carbon emissions and lower taxes on good things like federal income taxes. I know you don't have too many taxes that you pay here in Alaska, but in Washington State, for example, I'm part of a group that's working on a ballot measure campaign to replace part of the state sales tax with a carbon tax.
That doesn't sound very funny.
Well, you'd be surprised.
5 o'clock tonight, you can hear Yoram Bauman talking in front of the Juno World Affairs Council. It's absolutely free. It's happening in the studio 360 downstairs. Anything you want to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
I encourage folks to check out my website, which is standupeconomist.com. If you're interested in the carbon taxes, it's carbonwa.org. And just for the record, this is not an April Fool's Day joke.
Some of you who have small children may have perhaps been put in the embarrassing position of being unable to do your child's arithmetic homework because of the current revolution in mathematics teaching known as the new math. So as a public service here tonight, I thought I would offer a brief lesson in the new math tonight. We're going to cover subtraction. This is the first room I've worked for a while. It didn't have a blackboard, so we will have to make do with more primitive visual aids, as they say in the ad biz. Consider the following subtraction problem, which I will put up here. 342 minus 173. Now, remember how we used to do that. 3 from 2 is 9, carry the 1, and if you're under 35 or went to a private school, you say 7 from 3 is 6, but if you're over 35 and went to a public school, you say 8 from 4 is 6. And carry the 1, so we have 169. But in the new approach, as you know, the important thing is to understand what you're doing rather than to get the right answer. Here's how they do it now. You can't take 3 from 2. 2 is less than 3, so you look at the 4 in the tens place. Now that's really 4 tens, so you make it 3 tens, regroup, and you change the tens to 10 ones, and you add to the 2 and get 12, and you take away 3, that's 9. Is that clear? Now instead of 4 in the tens place, you've got 3 because you added 1, that is to say 10 to the 2, but you can't take 7 from 3, so you look in the hundreds place. From the 3, you then use 1 to make 10 ones, and you know why 4 plus minus 1 plus 10 is 14 minus 1, because addition is commutative, right? And so you got 13 tens, and you take away 7, and that leaves 5. Well, 6, actually, but the idea is the important thing. Now go back to the hundreds place. You're left with 2, and you take away 1 from 2, and that leaves... Everybody get 1? Not bad for the first day. Hooray for new math! New math! It won't do you a bit of good to read new math. It's so simple, so very simple, that only a child can do it. Now that actually is not the answer that I had in mind. Because the book that I got this problem out of wants you to do it in base 8. But don't panic. Base 8 is just like base 10, really. If you're missing 2 fingers. Shall we have a go at it? Hang on. You can't take 3 from 2. 2 is less than 3, so you look at the 4 in the 8's place. Now that's really 4 8's, so you make a 3 8's, regroup, and you change an 8 to 8 1's, and you add to the 2, and you get 1 2 base 8, which is 10 base 10, and you take away 3, that's 7. Okay? Now, instead of 4 in the 8th place, you've got 3 because you added 1, that is to say 8, to the 2, but you can't take 7 from 3, so you look at the 64's. 64. How did 64 get into it? I hear you cry. Well, 64 is 8 squared, don't you see? When you ask a silly question, you get a silly answer. From the 3, you then use 1 to make 8 1's. You add those 1's to the 3, and you get 1 3 base 8, or in other words, in base 10, you have 11, and you take away 7, and 7 from 11 is 4. Now go back to the 64's. You're left with 2, and you take away 1 from 2, and that leaves... Now let's not always see the same hands. One, that's right. Whoever got one can stay after the show and clean the erasers. Hooray for new math. It won't do you a bit of good to review math. It's so simple, so very simple, that only a child can do it. Come back tomorrow night. We're going to do fractions.
Tom Lehrer. 41 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned in to Juno Afternoon here on April Fool's Day for 2015. In studio with me now are Melanie Brown and Heather Hardcastle here to talk about salmon beyond borders in the University of Alaska Southeast, stories and science in our transboundary rivers. Heather and Melanie, thank you very much for coming down the station.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Happy April Fool's Day.
It's a national holiday for me.
Yeah, I bet it is.
You want to talk about the fifth film first?
Sure. I thought I might just back up a little bit, though, and just describe what Salmon Beyond Borders is and then how we got connected with Ryan Peterson, the filmmaker of Transboundary. Salmon Beyond Borders coalesced as a campaign about a year ago, and we're a collection of concerned citizens in Southeast Alaska who have been tracking the multiple mining projects that are in some stage of development just upstream of us in the Taku, the Stikine, and the Yunik watersheds. And all of this development is in Canada, in British Columbia. And last summer, Ryan Peterson, a local filmmaker from Anchorage, accepted our request to come to Southeast and interview folks about the issue and also fly over the Taku and the Stikine watersheds, as well as raft from source to sea the Yunik River, which was a pretty treacherous, adventurous experience, to say the least. And so his film, Transboundary, that we're showing on Friday at UAS, is a component of a bigger event that evening. But the film tracks the concerns of Alaskans and Canadians about this mining boom going on in British Columbia, but it also features this six-minute film that Ryan has put together.
Why should we care? We live in Alaska. Canada's another nation. How do we feel like we can influence their politics?
Well, that's a million-dollar question right now. But why we should care is because we're downstream of now at least 10 large-scale hard rock mining proposals, and we currently have no equal seat at the table as Alaskans to discuss how and if these watersheds are developed. And one of the major gold copper mines just opened on February 3rd in the upper reaches of the Stikine watershed. So it's actually happening in real time. And so the Salmon Beyond Borders campaign has been pushing for the state of Alaska and for the State Department, as well as our congressional delegation, to fight for that equal seat at the table for the U.S. and for Alaska to talk about these watersheds. And so Ryan's film and this event on Friday, Stories and Science of Our Transboundary Rivers, is just another effort on our part to keep raising awareness of what is going on upstream.
Melanie, where's the Yunik River?
The Yunik River, it flows through Misty Fjords National Monument, south of here, and it drains into, not quite directly into Ketchikan, but Ketchikan is in the path of that waterway, once it reaches the sea. And there are a couple of really large projects that are slated to come online fairly soon that we really need to be engaging on, and one is the KSM mine, and the other is the Brucejack mine.
The film is 6 or 7 minutes long, and that's not your whole evening.
That's right. That's right. So from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Egan Lecture Hall at UAS on Friday, April 3rd, Ryan Peterson will give a presentation and screen his film Transboundary. But then we also have some other guests. A notable one is Jacinda Mack, and she is a mining coordinator at the Northern Shuswap Tribal Council in Williams Lake, British Columbia. And Jacinda has an interesting story to share, which she will probably in a 20 or 30 minute presentation. She lives at basically ground zero for the Mount Pawley mine tailings disaster that happened in August of 2014. So she'll tell the story of her community and how they're grappling with the tailings waste and what it has done to their way of life. And then she'll also talk about how she's working with the British Columbia government on real mining reform going forward. And I think her message partly is, hey, if I were downstream of additional large-scale British Columbia mining projects, as we are here in Southeast Alaska, I would be very concerned. That's her message. And then we'll also have Dr. Dave Chambers, a geophysicist from the Center for Science and Public Participation in Bozeman, Montana. He'll be here to talk about the technical aspects of these mines. And we'll also have folks from Central Council Tlingit and Haida, like President Richard Peterson and Jennifer Hanlon from the Division of Lands and Natural Resources, to round out a panel discussion after Jacinda and Ryan and Dr. Dave, as we call him, give their presentations.
That presentation is free?
It is. We have a suggested donation of $5, and then students are free.
Eileen Brown and Heather Hardcastle, is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Oh, just that Ryan's film could easily be made into a feature-length film because of there's just so much to discuss and look at and scrutinize and engage on. And we would really like to pack the Egan Lecture Hall on Friday because people in Southeast really need to know about this issue. Our lives could be changed forever by these projects.
And that's happening starting at 7 o'clock?
7 o'clock, yeah, Friday, April 3rd. And I think come early because it sounds like we'll have quite a packed hall. So, but as Melanie said, please come out. We appreciate it.
All right, thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Fortune kind and kind and Tune in to KRNN for live broadcasts of the 41st Annual Folk Fest from April 6th to the 12th. This broadcast is made possible by the generous support of the University of Alaska Southeast, a learning community on campus and online. Information at uas.alaska.edu. That's the Alaska Folk Fest on KRNN. Support comes from the Juneau Convention and Visitors Bureau, hosting the 13th Annual Juneau Travel Fair, April 11, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Nugget Mall, with information on summer activities for Juneau residents and visitors. For more information, call 586-2201.
About 10 minutes before the hour, and you're tuned in to Juneau Afternoon here on April Fool's Day of 2015. In the studio now is Katrina Pearson, here to talk about artwork of Mitch Whiteley, who's going to be showing this first Friday at Heritage Coffee Club. Place downtown.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Katrina. So tell me about Mitch Whiteley, please.
I will. Mitch actually was raised in Texas, and he moved to Alaska about 9 years ago, and he married a Juneau girl, Sarah Esper Smith, and they have collaborated on a couple of really lovely children's books. This particular book is called I Would Tuck You In, and so Sarah wrote the text, and Mitch did the artwork. And the really interesting thing about this show is we're going to showcase some of the original pencil sketches, and those have never been displayed before. So you'll see these original ideas and pencil sketches and some of the evolutions of those. And then you'll see the final illustrations, and those are sketches that were scanned and then digitally painted. So they come out looking like watercolors.
That's fascinating. About what size are these?
We have several large pieces where we framed some of the, like three of the original pencil sketches in one piece, and then we have some smaller prints, and then we'll have the cards available as well, and the books.
And digital coloring sounds exciting.
It is, and it's really stunning when you see it. I brought a couple just to show you, and everyone else will have to come to Heritage to take a look. But when you look at it, you know, you see the original pencil sketch, and then you see the finished product. It really does look like a painting. It's really lovely.
It is. Yeah, I have to take my word for it, but just most people won't. They can see it at Heritage downtown at the corner of Front and Franklin Streets.
Yes, and it'll be up for the whole month of April.
I should say Sword and Franklin Streets.
Yes.
Anything you'd like to add? What else is that? Well, how's Shorefest Editions doing?
Oh, thank you. Shorefest is doing great. We've got some books that are coming up, being published, and then also I own Taku Graphics, and we're the folks who are partnering with Heritage to offer these art displays.
So the show opens up this first Friday?
Yeah, first Friday at 4:30 till close, kind of, you know, with the regular schedule of first Friday. So.
All right. Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks, Jeff.
Tomorrow on a June afternoon, we'll talk with M.K. McNaughton about this weekend's open studio tour. Beth Weigel will be here with an update of library activities. Find out about the Juneau Masonic Center and their new lodge. Margie Hamburger from the City Museum will be here to highlight their upcoming collaboration with Perseverance Theater. And Nancy Nicerny will be here with Arts App. That writer's almanac, Burnout Music and More, Thursday on a June afternoon. Tonight at 7 o'clock until 9 o'clock, we'll be able to hear highlights from last year's Alaska Folk Festival, which is coming up this Monday, live from Centennial Hall. KRNN will be broadcasting all main stage concerts. For the forecast for tonight, scattered rain showers early in the evening, then rain likely. Forecast for Thursday, rain likely. High temperatures around 44 degrees, east winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Forecast for Friday, mostly cloudy skies with scattered rain showers. Friday night, mostly cloudy skies, and Saturday through Sunday, mostly cloudy skies with high temperatures around 43 degrees.
The Wine Bar at the Silver Bow, offering wine by the flight, glass, or bottle, plus a selection of sparkling wine. The menu features wine-friendly foods such as cheese and charcuterie plates and desserts. Open evenings Tuesday through Saturday, downtown on 2nd Street. Details at silverbowbakery.com.